scheduled for oral argument this afternoon is case number 980329. Riccitelli, is that correct? Or Riccitelli? Chief Justice Abrahamson is not participating in this case. However, Justice Steinmetz, whose chair is two from me, is participating. And although you don't see him here, he is actually here because he is participating by phone conference. Don, can you hear us?
Don, can
yes.
Okay,
I'm with you.
Good. Justice Steinmetz participated in this morning's cases and had no problem whatsoever hearing, so you will be arguing to six justices. So, counsel, you may proceed.
May it please the court, I'm Dave Flanagan, Assistant Attorney General. I represent Dr. Frederick Brookhuysen, a professor of obstetrics and gynecology at the UW Medical School, and Assistant Professor Carol Haggerty, Clinical Assistant Professor of Clinical Obstetrics and Gynecology. There are two material facts which I suggest resolve this case. One is that this lawsuit is based upon actions taken by these faculty members, which were assigned to them by their employer, the University of Wisconsin Medical School. The other fact is that no notice of claim was filed. The governing statute is 893.82 sub 3, which in part says no civil action may be brought against any state employee for any act growing out of or committed in the discharge of the employee's duties unless the claimant serves upon the Attorney General written notice. There is one item of evidence which I suggest will offer a great deal of clarity to the relationship between the UW Medical School and Sinai Samaritan Medical Complex. The references in the record to Aurora Sinai, Sinai Samaritan. Aurora Healthcare is the corporate owner of the Sinai Samaritan Medical Complex, and I'll be saying Sinai Samaritan as I go through. That one item of evidence that I suggest is a guideline to that relationship between the medical school and its employees, the two employees who I represent, and Sinai Samaritan Medical Center, is an affiliation agreement, a 21-page affiliation agreement, which is in the appellant's appendix at pages 127 to 147. First let me refer, however, to the affidavit of Dr. Brookhuysen. I'm going to focus on Dr. Brookhuysen because there's been very little attention paid to Dr. Carol Haggerty, who holds a PhD in nursing and was an administrative worker in the same program. Dr. Brookhuysen offered the following affidavit, which is uncontradicted in this record. Paragraph 2 of page 149 of my appendix. My duties assigned by the University of Wisconsin Medical School, currently as well as during the period 1991 through 1995, include the supervision, instruction, and evaluation of resident physicians. Paragraph 3. All acts that I undertook with respect to the supervision, instruction, and evaluation of Dr. Guy Riccitelli's participation as a resident physician in the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology Residency Training Program at Sinai Samaritan Medical Center, July 1991 through August 1995, were done in the course of my duty as an employee of the state of Wisconsin, uncontradicted. Dr. Haggerty filed an affidavit which is substantially identical to that. Again, uncontradicted. Let me turn, if I could, to that affiliation agreement. That's an affiliation between the medical school and Sinai Samaritan or Aurora.
Counsel, I
yes.
Just need to interrupt. But when you say uncontradicted, in my mind immediately it jumped to his statement in the prior lawsuit where he says, you know, I wear several hats, and one of them is I work for the UW, and I head up the Sinai Samaritan, as well as I practice as a quote private physician. So does that in any way... that's the way he described himself and his duties. That's raised by your...
I'll deal with that right now, Your Honor. But let me first come at a peripheral point that you just suggested. It was said in the brief of the respondent that he had a role as a practicing private physician. In his testimony, he said his role, his third hat, if you will, was practicing physician. There is no evidence in this record, other than the evidence of his own, that he's a full-time member of the faculty. He does wear three hats. If you want to use the analogy of hats, that's fine. A simple analogy can lead to a little bit of confusion in a complex situation, however. But his hats. He wore a hat, he said, as a faculty member supervising medical students, because that's the context of that testimony. He wore a hat supervising resident physicians, and he wore a hat as a practicing physician. That's how you teach medical students and resident physicians. You practice medicine. It's a clinical education. But let me get to exactly what the question was. He was asked in that lawsuit not who he worked for. All parties in the 1995 lawsuit, this was before Judge D'Amato, agreed that he worked for the University of Wisconsin. I was there as his counsel. There was no issue as to who he worked for in that case. There was an issue of whether or not Dr. Riccitelli was a resident physician in a program of the University of Wisconsin, which meant that he could be terminated from that kind of a program using certain administrative procedures that would not be applicable if Dr. Riccitelli were an employee of Sinai Samaritan. The only issue before Judge D'Amato was, is Dr. Riccitelli an employee of the University of Wisconsin, or is Dr. Riccitelli an employee of Sinai Samaritan? His theory, as it's described in the Court of Appeals decision, his theory was, Dr. Riccitelli's theory was, my instructor, Dr. Brookhuysen, is an employee of the state of Wisconsin, so I must be an employee of the state of Wisconsin, too. That was the theory of the idea. So nobody was questioning Dr. Brookhuysen's employment. In the testimony that you're referring to, Your Honor, he's talking about the program at Sinai Samaritan, the resident physician program. And he describes, he's trying to describe and distinguish two groups of students, in effect. Third and fourth year medical students, which periodically come over to Sinai Samaritan from the University of Wisconsin in Madison, the medical school, and a different kind of student, a graduate medical student, a resident physician, who Dr. Riccitelli was. He was trying to explain, in terms of what he does in his job, how these are different people. The people from Madison, the students that are third and fourth year medical students, he tells in that specific portion of the testimony, he says, I report to the dean in Madison with regard to those people. And he distinguishes Dr. Riccitelli, a resident physician, saying, there I report to the people he works for, Sinai Samaritan. He's not talking about his employment. He's talking about Dr. Riccitelli's employment. And, yeah. But specifically, he's talking about the difference between Dr. Riccitelli and a fourth-year medical student. These are both people who he might supervise. He might well supervise them at the same moment. Supervision in that context, as the authorities I've offered in my reply brief indicate, supervision in that context is practicing medicine. He may well have a fourth-year medical student on his right hand and a first-year resident physician on his left hand. They may be doing exactly or something very similar to the same thing. And he was trying to distinguish something that really relates pretty closely together and can't be pulled apart that easily. And the way he chose to distinguish it was, who do I talk to when I'm talking about this person? Who do I report to say how his progress is going, how she's doing on such and such a procedure? In one case, it's somebody in Madison. In the other case, it's somebody in Milwaukee. That's what that testimony is all about. But let me take another point. Let me take another approach to that same question. He wears three hats. He wears two hats. It doesn't matter how many hats he wears. The question is, at whose behest does he put the hats on? And he was directed by the University of Wisconsin Medical School to go over to Milwaukee to work as a clinical teaching physician at the Milwaukee Clinical Campus, which, according to the agreement, there is an agreement, a specific written agreement between the medical school and Sinai Samaritan. According to that agreement, the medical school agreed to provide people to come over there to participate as instructors in Sinai Samaritan's residency training program. So the reason he was there was not because Sinai Samaritan said, wear that hat. It's because his employer here in Madison said, wear that Sinai Samaritan hat. It's not the best analogy in the world, but if we're going to follow it, let's follow it all the way through. And the question is, why is he wearing the hat? It's because that duty was assigned to him by the University of Wisconsin. Now, is this the suggestion has been that this is some sort of evasive sort of arrangement. If you look at the affiliation agreement, It's pretty obvious what is going on. Both entities have something to gain. The University of Wisconsin Medical School needs to have access to an urban patient population, both for research, which is provided for in that affiliation, and for offering clinical opportunities to third and fourth year medical students, called graduate, undergraduate medical education, even though they're all graduates of a bachelor's degree in any event. They need access to an urban patient population.
Mr. Flanagan, let me interrupt you for a minute. As you're talking about two hats or three hats, and before you get away from that, what's wrong with extending the doctrine, the dual persona doctrine from workers' comp to this kind of a situation where a person indeed is wearing two or three hats? Why shouldn't we be willing to do that?
Well, the dual persona doctrine starts with two principles. It's intended to clarify what had been a pretty confusing concept of dual capacities. And he certainly has a practicing academic physician acts in several capacities. Dual persona is supposed to depend upon two things, whether or not he has a second persona. If you look at the treatise by Professor Larson in workers' comp, he doesn't suggest that it's very easily found to have two personas in one person. Keep in mind, Dr. Brookhuysen and Ms. Haggerty are being sued personally. They're being sued personally for something they were told to do by the state of Wisconsin. But the reason not to extend it, it certainly doesn't apply to this particular case. Dr. Brookhuysen does not have a second persona, not a second legally accepted persona, and that which he was doing is supposed to be, according to the dual persona doctrine in the Henning case, an employer can become a third person vulnerable to tort suit by an employee if and only if he possesses a second persona so completely independent from and unrelated to his status as an employer by established legal standards, the law recognizes it as a separate legal person. Now, the only times this has been applied by this court has been workers, by appellate courts in Wisconsin, other than this case, has been workers' comp. And in two of those cases, what you have is a successor corporation. And the successor corporation couldn't pretend, when it took on the obligations of the first corporation, that those obligations somehow disappeared. The successor corporation still had to stand in the shoes of a corporation which was no longer there. There were two legal identities, two separate corporations. It was extended by the Court of Appeals beyond what Professor Larson would do in his treatise by saying that the 85% stockholder in a closely held corporation lost his immunity he otherwise would have had as an employer under workers' comp because the machine that caused the injury to the employee of the corporation had been leased to the corporation by that 85% stockholder. So the Court of Appeals was willing to see a lessor's role as a separate legal identity, but that still is. Here, we don't have a dual persona. We don't have two personas. We've only got one. And if Dr. Brookhuysen is found liable for something in this case, he's personally liable. He doesn't have some second
persona. Adding on to Justice Crook's question, was the, probably I missed this, the compensatory angle, was there any additional compensation to the doctor from Aurora? Did it all funnel through the University of Wisconsin?
It all funnels through the University of Wisconsin.
Under this 21-page agreement, which you referred to on one
page. Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor.
So there wasn't any outside compensation because I can imagine someone working, Justice Kirk's question is, I could see a dual persona or the extension in a capacity where a person is, say, working for one entity, and then working for, even though he was a full-time person, moonlighting or something like that for another entity. But that would involve compensation also.
Yes, sir. There was no compensation paid directly by Aurora Sinai to Dr. Brookhuysen or any other faculty member.
Did he get retirement benefits from the state based on the time that he spent as at the OBGYN department?
It's not in this record, Your Honor. But I know the answer, and I'm not going to give it.
Is he considered full-time faculty?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor. Full-time faculty is defined both in the administrative code under the University of Wisconsin. He's full-time faculty under that definition. He's full-time faculty under the definition of full-time faculty in the affiliation agreement between medical school and Sinus American. I asked myself, in preparing for the argument, I asked myself, how could Dr. Brookhuysen have had a dual persona here? And extending, first of all, extending the workers' comp dual persona theory to medical malpractice or defamation, which is what this probably is, it seemed to me that if we followed the Rauch decision, which was the corporate 85% shareholder that leased a piece of equipment to the corporation that caused injury, if Dr. Brookhuysen, on his own, unrelated to his employment by the university, leased a piece of medical equipment that was to Sinai Samaritan and it was used by patients, he would not have a workers' comp immunity that the plaintiff would be trying to get around. But that would, I suppose, be a dual persona because it would be unrelated to his work as a faculty. It'd be moonlighting as a lessor, and that's what was sufficient to invoke that theory in the Rauch decision. The other point under dual persona that I think is really important is the idea that what this person does in a second persona must be so completely independent from and unrelated to his status as an employer. Well, in this case, it would be so independent from and unrelated to his status as a faculty teaching physician. And as I was saying before, the teaching of the clinical teaching of resident physicians is the core of what he was retained to do, is what he was hired to do by the medical school, whether he's doing it here in Madison or if they send him over to Milwaukee to do it. Teaching a resident physician is the center of academic medicine with research, and also having other people there like third and fourth year medical students. This could not possibly be. His supervision of a resident physician was exactly what he was told to do by the university, and it certainly couldn't be so independent from or unrelated to his status as a clinical academic physician so as to call into being some sort of fictional dual persona. So for that reason, I don't believe, even if there were a value in extending this over to a different area of the law, I don't think it applies. And there's one more point I'd like to make, Your Honor, and that is the impact of the law that I'm trying to say applies here, the notice of claim requirement. In the Rauch decision, in Henning, and all the rest of these cases, the question was, is this plaintiff out of court? Does this employer hold complete immunity under workers' comp law? Black, white, up, down, yes, no. All I'm saying is that someone who is a claimant needs simply file a notice. File a piece of paper with the Attorney General. Then that problem is over with. Maybe there's a justification for the lawsuit. Maybe there isn't. This is a unique case in that this particular claimant was represented by counsel before he sustained the injury that he complains of. And his theory was that the person he's now going after, among others, was an employee of the state of Wisconsin. Why in the world would you not file a notice? It's not an onerous burden. That's all that's being asked of this claimant. That's all that was he was obligated to do. He wasn't out of court. His case wasn't at an end. He simply had to follow the statute that's pretty clear, saying he should file a notice within either 120 days if he called defamation or 180 days if he called medical malpractice. In either event, he had plenty of opportunity to comply with the statute. He wasn't looking at some clever immunity argument, something that's going to send him completely around the bend and the lawsuit's over. The medical school, clearly in that affiliation agreement, let me point out probably the most important thing. There is a contract between Sinai Samaritan, Aurora, and the medical school. There is no contract, there is no agreement, nothing suggests there's an agreement between Sinai Samaritan and Dr. Brookhuysen or any other faculty member.
Did he make application for chair of the department independent of any UW placement?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Let me ask.
I didn't quite follow.
Did he obtain the job as chair of the OBGYN department by independent application?
We don't have anything about that in this record, Your Honor. I think what we do have in the record is the affiliation agreement, which says that the medical school is to appoint all faculty members, and after first consulting with Sinai Samaritan, but the medical school appoints all faculty members. The affiliation agreement doesn't talk about termination, doesn't say that that Sinai Samaritan can terminate him, but implied in the ability to appoint is the ability to terminate by the university medical school. But to come around to what I think you're talking about is the privileges to practice medicine over at Sinai Samaritan. Dr. Brookhuysen, and any other faculty member, is required under the agreement between Sinai Samaritan and the medical school to apply for and obtain privileges to practice at that particular hospital. And in that sense, those privileges are independent of his faculty position. He would still be on the faculty if he didn't hold privileges over there. He would not be able to be assigned to that particular location if he didn't hold privileges over there. He'd have to work for the faculty someplace else. But I could go beyond that in light of other cases, but I don't think I should on this record, Your Honor. The basic statement, the basic guideline here, is the affiliation agreement. As I said, that it outlines the goals, the separate goals of both institutions, both related to training physicians, third, fourth year medical students to be trained on behalf of the university, resident physicians on behalf of Sinai Samaritan. It talks about liability. It makes it very clear that the medical students are the supervisory obligation and liability obligation of the state. It indicates under liability that 893.82 applies to the faculty. Explicitly indicates there's a section in that agreement on liability protection, page 138, 139. It indicates very clearly, I suggest, although the Court of Appeals disagreed, said it wasn't clear. It indicates, I think, in any fair reading, that the faculty members, full-time faculty members, are expected to be protected by 180, by the state indemnification provisions and the provision which enables the Attorney General to defend these folks. What the Court of Appeals has done is very, very significant, because it has said that when a faculty member is assigned to do a particular act, if that act benefits some non-state entity, that faculty member can be found to be personally liable under this dual persona theory. Now, if the faculty member is acting within the scope of his employment, he's entitled to be indemnified if there's some sort of a judgment against him for the actions that he takes pursuant to what he's assigned. He's entitled to be defended. But if the notice provision doesn't apply to this person, does he have indemnification rights? I don't know. I think not. If he's within the scope of his employment, surely there has to be a notice. If no notice has to be filed, even though he's somehow doing what the university told him to do, how can he be within scope of employment? If he's not in scope of employment, are all the faculty members who serve any interest anywhere outside the campus suddenly uninsured? The university is obligated by law to do extensive medical outreach, not to talk about other schools that do outreach as well. They do things, their faculty members and their students and preceptorships, do things that they've been told to do by the university someplace else. Now, if what they're doing benefits the university but also benefits some other entity, are they in dual persona? Are they in personal jeopardy for tort liability? Are they without legal protection if they find that they're being sued for something the university told them to do?
Could I ask you a question? The filing of the notice, there's a how long a period of time? 120 days, did you say?
Your Honor, it would be 120 days if it's not a case founded on medical malpractice. It would be 180 days from the date of the injury or the date that the injury was or should have been discovered if it's medical malpractice.
When did the 120 days start?
The 120 days starts from the date, from the act which produces the injury, the damage, the loss.
And that was when?
Presumably, in this case, it would be when Dr. Ricciatelli was terminated, dismissed from the program. That would have been sometime, I believe, in September of 1985. In August of 1985, I was over in Milwaukee at a preliminary injunction hearing.
It was after the first trial?
At the first trial, Your Honor.
Yeah.
There was a hearing on that injunction.
Okay, so there were 120 days after that.
After he was terminated, and I think that termination followed relatively quickly after there was no injunction ordered preventing it. So he had 120 days on the theory that this is a defamation case. He had 120 days from the date he was terminated, if he complains that termination was an act of Dr. Rukeisen.
Was there anything to preclude him from filing that notice during those 120 days?
Absolutely nothing, Your Honor. Absolutely nothing. The UW Extension goes all over the state doing things that benefit non-state entities. It's supposed to do it. The agricultural demonstration stations, the solid waste experiment centers, the employee-owned business program. I could go on much further. These are instances in which the university has been told by the legislature in Chapter 32 to go out and do things which will benefit people that aren't part of the university. The Wisconsin idea was a recognition back in the 30s and 20s that this expertise should be shared with the state. This decision of the Court of Appeals creates personal liability on the part of anybody who does the job that the university is supposed to be doing. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Flanagan. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Goldstein?
Thank you, Your Honor. Good afternoon, and may it please the Court. My name is Attorney Mark Goldstein from the law firm Padway and Padway, and I represent Dr. Guy Riccitelli, who is the plaintiff in this case and the respondent before this Court. And I believe this is a case of first impression. The issue is whether a doctor can shed his status as a state employee when it benefits him to do so in a lawsuit, and then later invoke that status as a shield against another lawsuit between the same parties. And I would disagree right at the outset with what Attorney Flanagan has said. There is an absolute and irreconcilable contradiction between Dr. Brookhausen's testimony in 1995, I heard him say 1995, and his affidavit submitted in the present case. In 1995, the parties were before Judge D'Amato regarding a request for an injunction against Dr. Riccitelli's termination from the OBGYN department at Sinai Samaritan. And Dr. Brookhausen testified, and I think it's very, very important to look at his exact words, "Whenever or wherever I have made decisions and communications, I've done that as a program director, right under the assumption that I'm acting on behalf of Sinai Samaritan Medical Center, not in my role as a UW faculty member." And another brief quotation, "As far as my residency program director duties, I report to the Sinai Samaritan Medical Education Committee," and then I have in brackets, he's referred to it previously, "and to that vice president, and I do not report to the chairman of the OBGYN department in Madison, which is to whom I report for medical school student teaching and other academics." And I would submit to this Court that that creates an absolute contradiction with what Dr. Brookhausen put in an affidavit 2 years later. There's no way to reconcile the two. And so Dr. Brookhausen has put the parties in this position. Dr. Brookhausen has put the plaintiff in this position. When Mr. Justice Prosser asked, was there anything to prevent Dr. Riccitelli from complying with the statute? Yes, absolutely there was. His reliance upon Dr. Brookhausen's sworn testimony. And to make the record absolutely clear, the parties went into the 1995 action, and specifically the plaintiff, claiming that Dr. Brookhausen was a state employee, that Dr. Riccitelli was a state employee, and that this was a state program. And it was the Court's decision in that case, the decision that it was not a state program, and it was Dr. Brookhausen's sworn testimony in that case, that he was not acting as a state employee, that caused Dr. Riccitelli to follow the course that he did. There's only one way to interpret Dr. Brookhausen's testimony, He acted against Dr. Riccitelli as an employee and actual agent of Sinai Samaritan, and not on behalf of the university.
You think, regardless of his quote relationship with the university, he can unilaterally expose himself in the sense of personal liability or liability in this case, even if the facts are that he was paid by the university, he was directed by them to do what he was doing, and that apparently is what you're surmising, that an individual can shed himself of this blanket of protections by his statement.
Your Honor, the short answer is absolutely yes. And the reason is because, to be absolutely clear about it, he was paid by the university. The monies, apparently, according to the affiliation agreement, come from Sinai. I would disagree with the court in the statement that he was directed by the university to undertake these actions. His testimony in the prior case was that he was not acting as a university employee.
Well, he wouldn't have gotten the job if he hadn't been working for the university if there wasn't a relationship outlined in that 21-page agreement, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
He didn't just go there and apply for this position, and they say, we'll hire him.
That's true. But he was also the chairman of the OBGYN department. He was a practicing, and I apologize to the court, we don't know that he was a private physician, but he was a practicing physician. So he held other responsibilities there. And my position is that when he's acting in those other capacities, in those other personas, if you will, and when he's acting as an actual agent of Sinai Samaritan, that, no, he does not get the benefit of the protection afforded him by the statute.
Mr. Goldstein, how would you draw a distinction between a dual capacity and a dual persona situation?
Your Honor, as I understand the case law, there isn't really a distinction to be drawn. The Henning case, this court said that it wasn't necessarily the capacity was improper. It was just that people can have a variety of capacities. The doctrine had been broadened, and persona was kind of a new effort and a new way to identify that. But I still think we're looking at the activities, the actions, and who they're undertaking those actions for. And again, we get back to the issue of control. Who was controlling their activities? By his own language, he was acting under the assumption that he's acting on behalf of Sinai Samaritan Medical Center. And to be absolutely clear about it, I would point out that his affidavit in this case does not talk about his program director duties. We're left to guess. You know, what was he to do as a program director? He talks about what he did as a state employee, but conspicuously absent is any discussion about what he did as a program director. We're also left to guess as to what Dr. Haggerty did as an assistant program director. So there's a very conspicuous absence from their affidavits, and I would submit to this court, I've relied in my brief on Russell and on the Darnell case, that affidavits presented, especially 2 years after the fact, that by Attorney Flanagan's admission are almost identical, which suggests who might have drafted them and what they're all about, cannot undermine testimony that was under oath 2 years prior. And that's, I think, the fundamental question. Again, I want to be clear. Whether Dr. Brookhausen spoke with the intent to deceive the parties back in 1995, or based upon his own confusion about who his employer was and what his roles were, we don't know, and we shouldn't surmise about that. But this is a very unique set of facts, and that's why I've proposed to this court, in addition to the dual persona doctrine, which the Court of Appeals relied upon, the doctrines of judicial estoppel, the doctrine of equitable estoppel, and constitutional issues such as equal protection and due process, that might also serve as a basis for this court to hold that that Dr. Brookhausen has to stand as a defendant in this case.
Counsel, does the doctrine of judicial estoppel apply where there are the same facts but different actions, or does it apply only in the same action?
Your Honor, I believe that it applies in different actions, and I would rely on State v. Petty, and also I believe it's the Yanez case, which talk about the fact that that there are different actions, but the same, different causes of action, but the same actions, the same testimony, the same facts that come about. And so I think especially this court's decision in State v. Petty does answer that question.
Petty deals not with just different causes of action, but different actions. Is that correct?
That may be. That may be.
I'm asking.
Your Honor, I know that in Petty we have a state action and we have a federal action, and there may be different actions. But the bottom line is that the court applied the doctrine of judicial estoppel in that case and found that I would defer to the language in that case. I can't call it to my recollection at this moment. But I merely offer judicial estoppel as a basis to suggest that if this court is unsatisfied with the way the Court of Appeals has addressed dual persona, that there are other bases on which to find that Dr. Bruckhausen and Dr. Haggerty should remain in this case. Now, one of the questions raised by the Assistant Attorney General is, what inequity has Dr. Riccitelli suffered? And I think that's very important to address, because I would submit to the court that the plaintiff is always the party that has the right to frame the issue, to frame the case to the court, to list the parties, to decide how the case is going to go forward. And there's a substantial difference between a party being just a witness and a party being a defendant. And one of those issues, differences I would submit is regarding discovery. At this stage, we don't know if Dr. Bruckhausen is available for deposition, whether he travels a lot, he might be out of the country. All of a sudden, Dr. Bruckhausen might not be subject to subpoena. And as a result, Dr. Riccitelli now has to go forward with his case without that very important piece of evidence. So that has an effect on how the case is treated by the attorneys involved and what evidence ultimately goes to the jury. And so I would submit that Dr. Riccitelli would suffer a grave injustice if these two defendants are let free from the litigation to simply be witnesses. Whether they appear or don't appear, whether they're subject to deposition, to subpoena, those are all very, very important.
What is the relief that you requested in your complaint?
In my complaint, I'm asking for contractual damages, breach of contract damages, mm-hmm. against Aurora and Sinai. And I've also alleged tort claims against Dr. Bruckhausen, Dr. Haggerty, and some others.
Now, if you were to prevail in those tort claims against Dr. Bruckhausen and others, would the University of Wisconsin be liable for any of them?
Your Honor, that's a good question, and the answer to the question is, I don't know. And the reason I don't know is because this court and others have held that the indemnity statute is not as broad as the notice statute. So just because the notice has not been complied with, if this court were to find that the case can go forward, doesn't necessarily mean, I believe, that the university would have the obligation of indemnity. I think that would be an issue to be litigated between perhaps Dr. Bruckhausen and the university.
One other question, counsel. This action took place at a meeting, right? The termination action?
The termination action took place at a modified hearing of some sort in 1995. Correct?
If on the way into that hearing room, Dr. Bruckhausen stumbled and fell, would he be eligible for workers' compensation from the university?
If Dr. Bruckhausen had slipped and fell? As an employee of the university, I guess the question goes to, why was he going to that meeting? I think the problem we're having, if I may backtrack just for a
moment. I mean, you understand the import of the question.
Certainly.
He's acting as an employee of the university, and at least I assume he was at this meeting.
And you're right, Your Honor, but I think we have to take a step back, because the real question is, how was he acting at the meeting? What capacity, what persona was he having? And the real issue then can't be answered, because all we have are these conflicting representations in the record. We didn't get very far in this case. We didn't have the opportunity yet for discovery. We don't have affidavits from other personnel at the university or at Sinai about what these individuals' roles were. So all we have is this conflict between Dr. Bruckhausen's statements in 95 and his statements in 1997 or 98. So the answer is, we don't know. If he was acting as a university employee, Perhaps he has a right of compensation against the university's workers' compensation carrier. Otherwise, perhaps it's against Sinai Samaritan's workers' compensation carrier. But it remains an issue because there wasn't a lot of factual development. And all we really have are the conflicts in Dr. Brookhausen's testimony and his affidavit.
Give me a hypothetical of what he was doing. You said it depends on what he was doing. What could he be doing that would be under the workers' comp for Sinai, and what could he be doing that would make it under the workers' comp of the state?
Well, Your Honor, I don't know that it, with all due respect, I don't know that it goes to what he was doing. I think it goes to which version of events we believe from Dr. Brookhausen. If he was doing this as a state employee...
Okay, you're using a conclusion. I want to know what activity is covered in Justice Babbage's slip and fall. You said, well, it depends on in what capacity. I guess that's what I heard.
No.
What does it depend on?
It depends on which version of events we believe from Dr. Brookhausen. It depends on if we believe what he said in 1995 or if we believe what he said in 1997 or 98.
I want a hypothetical. Forget what he said in 95 and 98. Give me a hypothetical doctor that is arguably in dual persona in these two positions. Give me a hypothetical that would cover them under one and then cover them in the other in a slip and fall. What is it?
In a workers' compensation situation. Well, I think the hypothetical would be that if Dr. Brookhausen, and if we look at his 1998 affidavit or 97 affidavit, if he was supervising, I think his words were supervising, evaluating residents, then he was doing that as a university employee, and then he would be covered by the university. But my point is, we're still...
What about the other?
We're still left to guess, because we don't know from his affidavit what his duties were as a program director or as a practicing physician. We just don't know from the information he's provided. And I'm hesitant to go outside the record to talk about that. The bigger problem, to my mind, is if we took this out of the hospital context and we looked at a customer that went into a shopping mall, and half of the employees are state employees and half of the employees are not. And who's to know? And how can one find out? And whose burden is it to make that information available? And I think that's really the core issue here. Dr. Brookhausen got full advantage of his testimony in 1995. The case was dismissed, the termination was allowed to proceed, and the court significantly relied upon his testimony in formulating its decisions. Decision. One of the findings of fact is that these employees were paid via Sinai, but through the university. And then the ultimate finding is the program was not a state program. I would submit to this court that the issue in 1995 was regarding status in a very general sense, a more general sense than Attorney Flanagan suggests. It was regarding the status of the program and regarding the status of the participants. And when Dr. Ricciatelli was informed by Dr. Brookhausen and by the court that the status of Dr. Brookhausen was as a private employee and the status of the program was as a private program, I don't understand how one can then still put the burden on him to file a notice of claim. And as an aside here, I think it's important to point out the differences between the 893-82 notice of claim statute and the 893-80. Two important differences. One is there is no excuse or equitable relief when the Attorney General had actual notice. And the second...
Actual notice isn't relevant in the state claim as it is against in a county claim, is it?
I don't follow you, Your Honor. I'm sorry.
My recollection under sub 80.80 that if you didn't file a claim, if they had actual notice, it's okay. But against the state, if you didn't file a claim, whether or not they may have had actual notice is irrelevant. Okay?
Correct. Right? Correct. And what I'm saying is 893-82 is particularly harsh in how it treats these claimants. And we don't know the legislature's basis for it. To a certain extent, we're not free to speculate about that. But I think that it calls to this court, even a greater necessity to fashion, whether it be the dual persona doctrine, whether it be judicial estoppel, whether it be equitable estoppel, to remedy this circumstance. I don't know what the inequity to the Attorney General is by going forward with this case. All these cases involve a certain type of balancing. And certainly the balancing in this case, on the one hand, foreclosing a claimant from going forward who had a reasonable reliance and a good faith belief that he was acting appropriately.
Are you suggesting, I'm not quite following, you said there's two differences between point 80 and point 82. One difference you just talked about, that is the difference between actual notice and not needing actual notice. Another difference is one asks the question of whether or not there's prejudice. If there's no prejudice under 80, it's okay. Again, prejudice is irrelevant under point 82.
Correct.
Am I correct on that? Are you suggesting that we should extend the prejudice from 80 to 82? Is that what you're
saying? I'm not asking this court to rewrite the statute. But what I am suggesting is that when this court looks at cases like Menino and Renner and Oney and some of the others I've cited, that this takes the doctrine even further. This takes the statute even further. This is a case where Dr. Riccitelli had no reason to think that Dr. Brookhausen was a state employee. In all those other cases, the court was very clear to say, well, and by the way, the plaintiff should have known. And in this case, there's really no way that Dr. Riccitelli should have known. Whatever thought he had that Dr. Brookhausen might be a state employee was certainly erased by Dr. Brookhausen's testimony in the case. And so what I'm saying is this pushes the envelope too far. And I think in reading those other decisions, the court was similarly troubled with the results. In fact, I think in Menino, the court said as much. It was similarly troubled with the result that the decision required, but was unable to come out and say the statute is therefore unconstitutional. And I think I would say that the distinction between those cases and this case is that in each of those cases, in Menino and Oney, even in Kishishian, which the Court of Appeals so heavily relied on, there's a statement by the court saying, and by the way, the plaintiff should have known that this was a state employee. That's the distinction I'm attempting to draw. I would also point, as I've indicated already, to the doctrine of equitable estoppel. An equitable estoppel has four elements, and I think they're all satisfied in this case. Action or non-action, we have sworn testimony here. By the party against whom the estoppel is asserted, Dr. Brookhausen is the party against whom we're seeking to assert estoppel, which induces reasonable reliance. And as I've stated in my brief, the cornerstone of our judicial system, one cornerstone, is that reliance on sworn testimony is reasonable. I don't think anybody would have trouble arguing that one. And the final element is that to the other party's detriment. And as I've indicated to the court, I think the dismissal of these two doctors from the action is to Dr. Riccitelli's detriment because it affects his ability to proceed with this case as he would like, to do the discovery that is necessary, and to put these defendants in the position that they should be in the case. I also think it's important to talk about Kishishian because the Court of Appeals did rely so heavily on that case. And the most important part of Kishishian is the negative inference that the Court of Appeals identifies, that an actual agent, acting as an actual agent, cannot receive protection from 893.82 simply because he also has state status. The Court of Appeals was very clear. I don't think they believed his affidavit submitted in 1997 or 98, Dr. Brookhausen's affidavit. They focused on his earlier testimony. And they determined that although he was an Aurora and Sinai actual agent, that he was also a state employee. And what I think the Court of Appeals decision says is you can't get the benefit of 893.82 if your actions are actions for the private employer, but you also have this state employment status. You have to look at the actions that were undertaken. Kishishian is also important for the following reason. The Attorney General relies very heavily on the fact that the affiliation agreements were almost identical. We just don't have those in the record. We have no reason to conclude that, no basis to conclude that. We're dealing with an OBGYN situation versus a nuclear cardiology department. There are different departmental agreements. And as the affiliation agreement says, the details of the affiliation, as well as functional and budgetary understandings, are set forth in these departmental agreements. So my point here is that I think that there are a lot of facts that are missing from this record, and there's no basis to say this case is exactly like Kashishian. But the Court of Appeals very readily said there's a negative inference one can draw from Kashishian. And that negative inference is that when you have someone who's acting as an actual agent of the private employer, they can't invoke 89382 protections simply because they also have the state status. I've also submitted to the court in my brief an argument that this case can also be affirmed on constitutional basis. And I pointed to the Equal Protection Clause and the Due Process Guarantees. And the Equal Protection Clause focuses the essential question is whether there are any real differences to distinguish the favored class from the other classes, and whether there's a rational basis which exists for that distinction. And I would submit to this court that whether that's true about state employees versus private employees, it does not apply in a hospital setting or any private setting where half or a quarter of the employees are state employees and the other half are private employees. As I say, this distinction is invisible to the naked eye. When Dr. Brookhausen is acting as a practicing physician, how is one to know that they're being treated by someone from the university, which requires now compliance with 89382, versus a private employee?
Well, isn't the rational basis premised on sovereign immunity? Isn't that the rational basis for the distinction?
That may be the rational basis, Your Honor, but what I'm looking at is from a different angle, and that is there is a distinction between state employees and private employees. I would acknowledge that. But what I'm saying is when the state delves into private arenas, when the state purchases Physicians Plus, or whatever else it might do, now you have some employees who are state employees and some who are private employees. And the problem it creates, and what I think may be broader than this case is about, but the problem it creates is, number one, the state has an advantage, a competitive advantage, over other employers, other HMOs. Their costs are less. The 89382 is a procedural hurdle, and 89382 has a set limit on damages, and that results in a competitive advantage against others in the market. But the other distinction is that you have, let's say, a radiologist or an anesthesiologist who now is covered by 89382. Well, a patient may never see that person, may never have any contact with that person. But if there's a tort or a medical malpractice or whatever it might be, they're charged with the knowledge that that person was a private employee. And a public employee. And what I would submit to the court is that in Menino especially, and in Renner by the Court of Appeals, the court has gone very far to say, we don't like it, but there were some indicators here. There were some reasons to think that, or for the plaintiff to have noticed or thought or observed that this was a public employee. In this case, it certainly was not true. Dr. Ricciatelli was relying on sworn testimony, which, as I pointed out at the outset, is in direct conflict, and to my mind, is uncontroverted in and of itself. And the reason I say that is because I think there are significant holes in the affidavits that have been submitted. There are significant questions about the basis for those statements and what's not stated in those affidavits. And I refer this court to the Darnell case, to the Russell case, which talk very clearly about efforts to patch up prior testimony and how the real indicator before the courts is what's said on the record under oath.
One of the things I hear you arguing is, well, in these situations where there's kind of a mixture, it's a state's, you know, in what is perhaps private enterprise or decision relationship, it's hard to know when they're acting as a state employee as opposed to a private employee. That argument seems contrary to the argument that you should be making that for dual persona, for dual personas, I understand it, they have to be completely independent from and unrelated to the status as employee, state employee in this case. So you can't have it both ways.
Well, I would submit that I can. And
okay.
The reason is because, number one,
if you can,
I've submitted some alternative theories to the court.
Okay.
And I would agree that to a certain extent, judicial estoppel and equitable estoppel and the constitutional arguments I've made do not match up entirely with dual persona. But the other thing is, the focus is different. The focus is on their actions versus the appearance. And I've looked at equitable estoppel, at judicial estoppel. Those doctrines deal with what is portrayed. And dual persona focuses on what was done. And I think that's the important distinction. And I think either way, I think Dr. Ricciatelli has the right to proceed against these defendants.
Well, I'll let you say there's the focus of actions and appearances, but as I read the test, an immune person may be subject to tort suit only if, quote, he possesses a second persona so completely independent from and unrelated to his status as an employee that by established legal standards, the law recognizes it as a separate legal person.
Correct.
It almost sounds like there's a nuance. No, it's what their actions are and not what the appearance is. Well, that seems kind of interrelated to me.
It may, Your Honor, and all I can submit is that the dual persona doctrine, the basis for the Court of Appeals decision, is that Dr. Brookhausen was acting as an actual agent of Sinai Samaritan. And as an actual agent, he should be exempted from 893-82.
Do you think Court of Appeals is right in extending this dual persona here?
I think it fits very well. I think it fits this very unique set of facts.
Are you hedging your bets with all these others?
No.
No? Okay.
There's no penalty for offering up alternative theories.
Right.
And I make no apologies for doing so. But I do want to address that because I want to say that when I started this case, before the trial court, before the Court of Appeals, I thought this was an issue about issue preclusion. I thought Judge D'Amato had answered. And what the Court of Appeals told me, what the trial court said was, no, I offer some alternative theories as a result. Thank you very much.
Counsel, I have one question. I want to get back to the purpose of those seemingly off-the-wall questions I asked you, because we seem to have forgotten, at least we haven't discussed, the purpose of the statute. And the purpose of the statute, among others, at least in my view, is to put the state on notice that it has potential exposure. And if you prevail, you thwart the purpose of this statute, do you not?
No, Your Honor.
Given the answer that you gave to my questions, there clearly is potential exposure on the part of the state.
There is. And what I would suggest is this. Number one, this is a very unique set of facts. This is not the same set of facts that come up in medical malpractice cases, although it may be that that's what the next case would be after Menino, after Renner, after Oni. But I would also indicate that there's a balancing that always has to be undertaken. And the balancing has to be between that very important role that the statute serves of putting the Attorney General on notice and the other side, which is closing off potentially meritorious claims. And I would submit to the court, as a practicing attorney, I don't think I've ever received a response to a notice of claim, let alone a denial or a statement that it's been investigated. So, although this is going a little bit outside the record, what I would submit is when the notice of claim statute is being misused, when it's being misused because it's extended to people that it shouldn't be extended to, or because it's just being used as a procedural obstacle and not for the purposes it was intended, then I think it's incumbent on this court to look at that and to address it. And the court suggested that in its prior decisions. And the Law Review article I cite suggests that as well. This is an unusually harsh statute with no equitable exceptions. And I think that's significant.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Goldstein. Mr. Flanagan, you have 5 minutes.
.893-82, the notice requirement, is intended to tell the Attorney General that there's potential liability out there. But I'd like to go back to where it comes from. It was created as part of a comprehensive plan for dealing with state tort liability on behalf of state employees, in 1973. It's been around pretty much as it is today since then. The legislature has chosen not to change it. The limits have gone up. The time to give notice has gone out further. Medical malpractice cases have incorporated a discovery provision. But both the appellate courts and the legislature have chosen not to change that, what is now a 25-year-old statute. In fact, in 1991, the legislature added a clarifying provision which requires strict compliance with the notice procedure or no lawsuit. Complying with it is not that difficult, not in this case. In some cases, it might be, and it might present a terrible dilemma for you, but not in this case. We have a doctor who started in legal proceedings before he had a claim on the theory that he was dealing with a state employee, and he was represented by counsel. There might be other more difficult cases, but this is not the case. But I'd like to... What Mr. Goldstein focused on was the testimony of Dr. Burkheisen. So I'd like to look at that for just a moment. And he tells us that that's in direct conflict with what I think is a fairly explicit statement in the affidavit. And that explicit statement is, at page 149 of my appendix, all acts that I undertook with respect to the supervision, instruction, and evaluation of Dr. Guy Ricciatelli's participation as a resident physician in the Department of OBGYN Residency Training Program in Sinus American, July 91, August 95, were done in the course of my duty as an employee of the state of Wisconsin. We're referred to testimony in which Dr. Burkheisen says, referring to the residency program, it's very well known that it is affiliated with the UW, but the program is run by Sinus American Medical Center. The evaluation of this is being reviewed by the Sinus American Medical Education Committee, which is chaired by Vice President for Academic Affairs, etc. And as far as my residency program director duties, I report to that committee and to the Vice President, and I did not report to the chairman of the OBGYN department in Madison, which is to whom I report for medical school student teaching and other academics. Then we go on to two hats, three hats. Well, let's just take a second and see just who that education committee, policy committee is, because at page 11 of the affiliation agreement, page 137 of my appendix, Aurora and the medical school agreed to establish a joint educational policy committee which shall consider and make recommendations to the board of directors of Aurora and to the medical school dean on matters related to the educational programs of the medical school and to the graduate medical education programs of Aurora, and goes on to talk about the cooperation on that committee between those two entities. The committee shall meet as often as determined necessary by the majority of members, but at least annually. The dean of the medical school and the president of Aurora shall serve as the co-chairman of the educational policy committee. The fact that he reports to that committee does not, I suggest, say that he somehow is no longer an employee of the state of Wisconsin. We don't know what the departmental agreements are.